So did you see the frontal assault on the field of epidemiology in the Times magazine yesterday? Epidemiology, even if you don't know the word, affects you every day. It's the study of illness in populations. It's the field that figured out that smoking causes lung cancer, and the field that still can't figure out whether hormone replacement therapy is good or bad for which women. To science writer Gary Taubes, the field itself is fundamentally flawed and leads us all to many decisions about what foods to eat, what drugs to take, and a whole lot more that are bad decisions. Epi is at its worst, he says, when trying to help us to prevent disease, especially in the area of diet. This is every bit as explosive as Taubes' other cover story in the Times magazine about how fat might not make you fat. You may remember we devoted an entire show to that one when it came out. Gary Taubes also has a related book coming out called Good Calories, Bad Calories, Challenging the Conventional Wisdom on Diet, Weight Control, and Disease, to be published later on this month by Knopf. And he joins us again now. Gary, welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Brian.
And full disclosure, I took a number of epidemiology courses in grad school.
Uh-oh.
And have great admiration for the dedication of epidemiologists who consider themselves health detectives looking for clues as to what makes us sick and what keeps us healthy. Why did you write this article?
Well, I have been, it's been about a dozen years now I've been writing about public health, and the basis of most public health decisions come from this kind of observational epidemiology. A dozen years ago, I had an article in Science called Epidemiology Faces Its Limits, where I addressed some of the problems. And then as I continued to work in the field, my thoughts on this subject continued to gel. So this latest cover story for the New York Times Magazine was addressing what I consider the sort of absolute fundamental problem with the science.
And you used the practice of hormone replacement therapy in menopausal women to illustrate this fundamental flaw or limitation. Maybe take us through that example for people who didn't read the piece.
I will. With the hormone replacement therapy, the idea this about in the 1950s and 1960s, when women took estrogen therapy for menopause, they took it as a means to suppress their symptoms. You have hot flashes and other discomforting symptoms. You take the drug, you feel better. In the 1960s, 1970s, this idea came about that HRT, as it's known, can also prevent heart disease. So what happens is you end up with these observational studies. The example I use is the Nurses' Health Study from Harvard, where there's 120,000 women nurses all around the country, and every 2 years they ask them questions about diet and lifestyle and drug prescription.
And let me jump in for a minute on that number before it just kind of vaguely goes by. 120,000 people in a study. This is one of the reasons that study has so much clout, because the sample size is so huge. If you follow 120,000 people for anything, supposedly you're going to get some really meaningful results.
Well, that's the idea behind it. You get these huge studies, and they are relatively inexpensive despite these huge numbers. The alternative way to test the benefits of something like hormone therapy is to do a randomized control trial. So if you want to take, say, 20,000 women and randomize half of them to taking the therapy and half of them to not taking it and then follow them for 10 years, it's going to cost you a few hundred thousand, maybe $1 billion. Here, what you do is you just start with three women who are already out there. You ask them whether they're taking the drug or whether they're not. And then you look, you follow them for 20 years or 5, 10 years, and you see what diseases they get. And then you compare the diseases they get to the drugs or they're taking or the diet they're eating or the exercise regime they're doing. And you make some conclusions where you say women, in this case, women who take hormone replacement therapy have, depending on when you were looking at this, from 30% to 50% to 70% the heart disease rates of women who are not taking therapy. And the fundamental question is, does that mean that the reduction in heart disease is caused by the hormone therapy?
And that's what they still can't figure out.
And that's what they, well, yeah, or depending on who you ask, you get a confident answer that's entirely different from someone else you ask.
Right, and the conventional wisdom just in the last few years, based on observations from these studies, has been going back and forth.
Yeah, what happened is, well, first you had this idea that hormone therapy dramatically prevents heart disease. And the women who take it have dramatically less heart disease in women who don't. Then in the 90s, the American College of Physicians, the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecologists start recommending hormone therapy as a means to prevent heart disease, especially for women at high risk. So now you turn around and you say, let's see if we're right. Now that we've recommended it, let's see if we're right. And you do controlled trials. You do these randomized trials that I mentioned. And 1998, the first such study comes out, HERS, and you find out that, lo and behold, if women have already had heart disease and you give them estrogen, it makes it worse. And then in 2002, this enormous Women's Health Initiative trial comes out and also says that even for women who appear to be healthy, estrogen, if anything, causes more harm than good. So now the question is, why this discrepancy between the observational studies that show this dramatic improvement and the clinical trials that don't?
Do you have a hypothesis?
I have a hypothesis, as do the people who do the observational trials. The idea is with these observational studies, and by observational study, I mean you're just watching women. You're recording what they do and you're following them. And what you find out, again, as I said, is women who take hormone therapy have less heart disease than women who don't. But the problem is women who take hormone therapy are different than women who don't. And they're different in numerous, perhaps unquantifiable ways. They tend to be wealthier. They tend to have more education. They tend to be more health conscious in a lot of different ways. They probably smoke less. They probably have less heart disease risk factors to begin with.
Unquantifiable is a huge word there to me, because if you're saying unquantifiable, you're saying there are things that can't be measured, and so you can't get this kind of science right.
When that's the fundamental issue. The people who do these studies say, we can measure enough about these women that we can predict with reasonable, we can say with reasonable reliability, and reasonable reliability as depends on how you define it, that what we're seeing is a cause and effect relationship, that hormone replacement therapy is playing some role in preventing heart disease. The critics, the skeptics who, you know, you can argue that because skepticism is a requisite characteristic for any science, the more skeptical you are, the more like a scientist you act. The skeptics say that kind of confidence is impossible because you never know what you didn't measure. You never know what you missed.
You never know what you missed. But many of the things that you mentioned can be measured. Somebody's education level, what other drugs they're taking, whether they're smokers or not. Those are things that all these studies try to correct for.
Indeed, they do. But the question is, do they do a good enough job? Do they undercorrect? And again, what do they miss? For instance, if you start the study in the 70s and you think, okay, we look at cholesterol, total cholesterol, we look at diabetes, and these are the heart disease risk factors. But since the 1970s, our concept of heart disease risk factors have changed. So it goes from total cholesterol to LDL cholesterol. Now there's something called small dense LDL, which is supposed to be the true risk factor for heart disease. Well, you never mentioned, you never measured small dense LDL at all. So maybe measuring total cholesterol isn't good enough. You know, you've got diabetes, and you say, yeah, do you have diabetes or not? But now there's this concept of metabolic syndrome, which is a kind of pre-diabetic state. It's also a pre-heart disease state. So maybe you should have been measuring metabolic syndrome in the 70s, and if you had been, you'd have found out that the women who take hormone replacement really are just healthier because they're a healthier type of women.
I wonder if any epidemiologists are listening. I have a feeling epidemiologists may have read this article and fumed yesterday. This is a handful of people relative to the population, but if any epidemiologists are listening right now, we want to hear from you to defend your field at 212-433-WNYC, or maybe to agree with some of Gary Taub's critiques of it and descriptions of what he sees as the limitations of epidemiology to tell us how to keep ourselves healthy. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. As we talk about this cover story in the New York Times Magazine yesterday, maybe you read it. Here's an alternative hypothesis before we throw out everything that we're learning from observational studies and use it to help us decide what lifestyle to live to stay healthy. An alternative hypothesis. Modern epidemiology is a very young science and gets more sophisticated over time. It's given us fabulous big findings like that smoking causes lung cancer in many people and blood pressure causes heart disease in many people. In more complex cases, like with hormone replacement, it takes time to ferret out what's best for whom, and they're doing it. with misleading clues along the way. But now Epi has begun to give us a complex picture of which women it is likely to help and which women it is likely to hurt, along with those clinical randomized trials. And the refinements in our understandings continue.
Yeah, and I'll agree with everything you said. The issue is the word likely. Okay, it's likely to tell us which women it's able to help, and it's likely to tell us which women it's able to hurt. What it's doing is saying, it's not an issue. It deals with symptoms. If you have symptoms and the symptoms are bad enough, basically we make a risk-benefit analysis every day. We all have symptoms, and we say, I'm going to take this drug, or I'm going to take that aspirin, and hopefully it's not going to kill me 10 years from now, but at the moment, whatever my symptom is bugging me. You know, we're talking about starting with otherwise healthy women and telling them that if they take this, maybe 10 or 20 years from now, this will, have some minor effect on preventing heart disease.
And let me broaden this from hormone replacement therapy, because I know this ties in to some of the major themes of your book, good calories, bad calories, challenging the conventional wisdom on diet, weight control, and disease, which is coming out. And to ridiculously reduce your position, you're sort of more in the Atkins camp than in a low-fat camp, which might have a higher carbohydrate diet. Is that fair?
Well, it ridiculously reduces it. And one of the reasons I say the things I say in this article is because in my book, I make at least a compelling argument that your term, the alternative hypothesis, would have been my ideal title for the book if my editors didn't think that I would limit the readership by about 90%.
That only scientists would read it if
you
said that.
But the alternative, you make an argument for an alternative hypothesis, and then you point out that the reason the alternative hypothesis has never been taken seriously is because these epidemiologic studies are out there that never bother to look at it. So, for instance, one of the reasons we believe low-fat diets are good for us is because there are these countries like Japan that eat low-fat, high-carbohydrate diets compared to America, and they have less heart disease, less breast cancer. But they also ate considerably less sugar. And we never looked at sugar. Nobody, by all these studies, 50, and this is what I mean by you don't know what you don't miss. If you don't measure everything, you don't know whether there's a factor out there that maybe you should have been measuring.
They didn't look at sugar. I mean, I don't know every study that's ever been done or reported, certainly, but all of us, almost no matter what generation we're from, get told that sugar is bad for us from the time we're little kids.
Yeah, we used to be told that. Then it became kind of a sort of mild empty calories is what it is. Nobody says sugar causes heart disease because in the 1970s, we were too busy saying fat causes heart disease. What if sugar does? Well, science is about making these, basically trying to think up everything humanly possible that you can that could explain it, and then refuting the ones that you can possibly refute. But what these people do is they come up with a hypothesis, and then they try to confirm it's true. They're not clever. They don't believe it's incumbent upon them to throw up every possible alternative because it's too easy to do in epidemiology. You know, when we were talking about hormone replacement therapy, I listed maybe 5-10 different things that could possibly explain the observations they saw. So in a real science, each one of those things would be rigorously analyzed. You'd have dozens, hundreds of papers on it saying, can this be ruled out? In this science, you get a single line in the paper saying, well, we looked at this and we don't think it can explain the data. And that's simply not good enough.
Let's take a phone call. Rob in the Bronx. Rob, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, I'm a cardiologist. I loved your article. I have to confess, I felt similar skepticism for the evidence about a low-sugar diet also. I'm curious if you can tell us how we know we can support that, too.
Well, the problem is you can't because nobody bothers to test it. And it's true, when the observational studies look at sugar consumption, it's actually an excellent case. In the 1980s, for instance, there were observational studies that showed that fat people eat less sugar than thin people. And this was used to argue by the sugar industry, among other people, that sugar is a weight loss tool. Because if lean people eat more sugar, i.e. that's an association, now we're going to go to the cause and effect, eat less sugar, weigh less. Okay, but the reasons why lean people eat less sugar, maybe fat people know they're fat and don't want to be fat, so they're not eating, they're not drinking Coca-Cola, they're drinking Diet Coke, they're not drinking, eating cake. So they're staying away from sugar because they have a propensity to gain weight.
But do you think that's the actual case in the real world?
Yeah. Actually, I mean, look, there was recently a study that came out.
You think heavier people eat less than lighter people?
I think heavier people try to eat less all the time. They don't want to be heavy. You know, so it's actually one of the interesting points. It's excruciatingly difficult to show that heavier people eat more than lean people. And if somebody's heavy, it is an interesting point I make in the book. What's the definition of overeating? Well, if you're fat, you overate, period. Okay? If you're thin, you could eat as much as you want. We all know thin people have, what's, you know, voracious appetites.
Unless you're fat for genetic reasons.
Well, the question is, in genetics, nature always interacts with nurture. So you had Gina Collada on the show a few months ago talking about the problems with losing weight, but the issue she didn't confront is genetics interacts with nurture, the environment. If we are getting fatter, something is triggering that. And if you're not going to say it's eating too much or exercising too little, then it's something else.
So, Rob, as a cardiologist, what are you going to recommend to your patients tomorrow?
I don't think I'm going to make a diet recommendation. I'd love to say, look, I'm not, you know, I think the same reasons you say we don't know what to say about hormones. We don't know whether to say that about sugar either.
What about observations from your own practice? Do you think just by seeing patients that you can see patterns, whether it's diet or exercise or cholesterol levels or whatever some of these variables are, that that you can say with confidence associate with risk?
Well, one thing I just want to say, I agree with Dr. Taubes that in most of my fat patients, they tend to be eating less than the rest of us.
Huh.
I stuck them in metabolic studies and found this to be the case. You put them on a diet that's the same amount, like standard 2,000 calorie diet, and a lot of them say, this is a lot more food than I'm used to eating. You supervise them, they can gain weight on that.
Thanks. It's an interesting, one of the points I make in the book, by the way, is prior to World War II, there was a very interesting hypothesis about obesity that had been worked out by European physicians and clinicians who treated fat people regularly. There also tended to be endocrinologists who studied hormones or geneticists. And one of the things they did is they saw patients every day. So they knew their fat people were trying as hard as they could to be thin, or at least not to get fatter. After World War II, there's about a 10-year gap in the 1940s, and then afterwards, the field is kind of recreated by nutritionists at the Harvard School of Public Health. And these people are nutritionists. They don't treat patients. And from nutritionists, we went to psychologists. So right then, you went from people who don't treat patients at all to people whose business is treating behavioral disorders. And we've never come back from that. Ever since then, we have treated obesity, a disorder of excess fat accumulation, as a behavioral disorder of overeating and sedentary behavior. And it's funny, when I speak to doctors, they often tell me, look, I don't tell my obese patients to exercise because I know it doesn't help, and it only makes them hungry.
Exercise doesn't help.
Exercise makes you hungry. It does not make you lean.
Does exercise... Well, I'll tell you what, before we go down that rabbit hole, we're going to take a break. And then when we come back, I'm going to go down a short list of things that are, I guess, are based on epidemiological findings, and ask you, true or false, if you think the science really backs it up, mostly with respect to diet, exercise, and health, but also a few other things, okay?
Okay.
Gary Taubes, my guest on WNYC, his cover story in the New York Times Magazine this week, Unhealthy Science. His new book, Good Calories, Bad Calories, Challenging the Conventional Wisdom on Diet, Weight Control, and Disease. And we'll take more of your phone calls. More cardiologists, epidemiologists, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Gary Taubes, author of the Unhealthy Science cover story in the New York Times Magazine this week, and the forthcoming book that takes that idea and focuses mostly on diet and exercise and your health, Good Calories, Bad Calories, Challenging the Conventional Wisdom on Diet, Weight Control, and Disease, coming out later this month from Knopf. And let me go down a list of some common beliefs based on epidemiology and tell me if you think the science, as far as you're concerned, really doesn't back them up. Certain cholesterol readings are associated with heart disease rates.
Yes, that's true.
That's true. Taking statin drugs to lower cholesterol helps prevent repeat heart attacks in populations of people who've had one.
And taking statin drugs helps prevent heart attacks. That's true. That's based on clinical control trials, not epidemiology. And what we don't know is whether it works because it lowers cholesterol.
Right. So one of the debates among cardiologists, as I understand it, is whether statins prevent heart attacks in people with high cholesterol, but no heart attacks previously, because we don't know if those people are prone to have them.
That's a little bit convoluted for me. What I would say that the relevant point is for me is, for instance, aspirins prevent heart attacks, and aspirins get rid of headaches, but that does not mean that they work on heart attacks by getting rid of headaches, and that anything that gets rid of headaches will get rid of heart attacks.
Aspirins are blood thinners.
But the question is, so the question with cholesterol, with the statins, is does it work by reducing total cholesterol? Does it work by reducing LDL cholesterol? Does it change the nature of the LDL particle itself? If you actually read the official reports, you'll see that there's an explanation that would suggest that rather than that statins work in a way that would make you wonder if the correct dietary analogy would be to eat less carbohydrates rather than less saturated fat.
Some cardiologists think that total cholesterol level is completely meaningless, but that's another show.
It's always been completely meaningless.
You think so?
Yes. LDL cholesterol, maybe not. Total cholesterol has always been a canard.
True or false? Japanese women have very little breast cancer. Third-generation Japanese-American women have American rates of breast cancer.
That's true.
Is that a success of epidemiology?
That is a success of epidemiology. But what has the failure of epidemiology is the inability to tell us what it is about the American lifestyle that causes breast cancer, what it is about the Japanese lifestyle that prevents it.
And epidemiologists basically acknowledge that, right? Most people throw up their hands and say, we don't know what causes breast cancer.
That's true. Absolutely.
Do you have a hypothesis?
Yes, I do.
Which is?
The refined carbohydrates and the sugars in the diet.
Even breast cancer.
Even breast cancer. You know, when I started my book 5 years ago, I never imagined in a million years that I would say something like this. You look at the epidemiologic data, which is very valuable in these cases. Again, they can tell you reliably about distributions of diseases. What they can't tell you about is the causes. So what you know is that you have these nations that have very low cancer rates. All cancers are like this. This is why researchers, you know, it's conventional wisdom that most cancers can be prevented. The question is, what is it that causes it and what do we have to avoid?
All right. True or false? As far as you're concerned, certain patterns of exercise, cardiovascular exercise, help prevent heart disease.
I have to go with false on that one. What's true is that people who have low levels of heart disease tend to exercise more than people with high rates of heart disease. The question is it the exercise, it's the cause and effect issue again. Health associates with more physical activity. Does more physical activity make you healthy? The only way to know for sure is to do a clinical controlled trial, and those trials have yet to be done. Although there is one such trial in the works at the moment for diabetics.
For people who are already diabetic, but how do you take a diabetic and put them in an experimental group that tells them not to exercise? Can you ethically do that?
That's one of the real problems with any randomized controlled trial that involves some lifestyle modification. Often what happens is you find that the control group, the group that you're telling not to exercise or not to eat a healthy diet, starts to eat a healthy diet anyway or starts to exercise anyway. And sometimes because they know that's what the study's testing. And then what you find out is at the end of 10 years, you've spent this enormous sum of money to randomize people into two entirely different groups, and the two groups aren't that entirely different.
Right. Well, what about this famous epidemiological study? In England, and I didn't look it up, so this is from memory, and I may have some of the details wrong, but in England with trolley drivers who sit still all day to drive the trolley versus the trolley ticket takers who moved around all day taking tickets, and they had lower heart disease rates after many years on the job. Familiar with that one?
Yes, I am. And that's very familiar. I don't know if you saw, there was a recent New York Magazine cover story on why New Yorkers live longer. And, of course, the accepted hypothesis, we move here and we walk everywhere, and therefore it's the walking that makes us live longer. But what you find out is when you have a city full of young, wealthy, affluent people, you know, if you're overweight and you're uncomfortable walking a lot, you're probably not going to move to the city. well, you have to walk a lot. So the question with that trolley study is, did the trolley drivers become drivers because it was too tiring for them to take tickets all day long, and therefore they were unhealthier to begin with?
Steve in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Gary Taubes. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Brian. I wanted to ask his opinion on the science behind the recent trans fat ban in New York City. I can tell you that I have a bakery. It's forced us to go from using things which used to be trans fats, like shortening, margarine, things like that, and then changing to using things, you know, which have low are low in saturated fats. And now we've ended up changing to things like butter and other ingredients that are high in saturated fats. And I'm wondering, I don't know if that falls into unintended consequences.
Right, but low in trans fats, I understand. And you know, Dr. Thomas Frieden, the head of the New York City Health Department, will swear by the importance of getting trans fats out of the diets, and he's going to cite study after study.
Well, here's the problem. And Steve, I apologize for my book, because the good news is I don't buy the trans fat story, but the bad news is I think that everything else you're using to make the bread and the croissants is the bad stuff. Here's the trend. The trans fats are fascinating because they're a great example of this. Now, trans fats...
you don't mean the butter and the saturated fats. You mean the sugar and the
dough. I mean the sugar and the dough, yeah. Trans fats lower LDL, the, quote, bad cholesterol, and they raise LDL and they lower HDL. So supposedly, in that sense, they're bad for our cholesterol profiles, and that's part of the reason to link them to heart disease. Funny, curious enough, estrogen was supposed to do the opposite, which is one reason why people thought estrogen therapy should be good for women, because they raised HDL and lowered LDL. The epidemiologic evidence is a good example of the problem I'm talking about. When studies like the Nurses' Health Study, which has been pushing against trans fats for 15 years, what they do is they send out these dietary questionnaires and they try to assess how much trans fats all these 120,000 nurses, actually I think it's 82,000 nurses who get diet questionnaires, how much they eat, and then they break it down into quintiles. So you have the women who eat the 20% of women who eat the least trans fats, and they compare them to the 20% of women who eat the most trans fats. So now you ask, what foods are trans fats show up in? And for the most part, they show up in processed foods and fast foods and, I guess, foods from bakeries. So you're looking at the 20% of women who eat the least processed foods and the least fast foods, and you're comparing them to the 20% of women who eat the most. So you're comparing, for instance, women who can cook at home every meal, women who buy everything fresh, women who, you know, probably are higher educated, probably are richer, are entirely different.
But funny enough, breast cancer in particular seems to associate with wealth, whereas these other diseases you're talking about, heart disease in particular, tends to associate with poverty.
That is indeed true. I'm not as familiar with the breast cancer data, but I wouldn't be surprised if it associates with health.
Here is an epidemiologist, Dr. Mark Billsley in Brooklyn. Dr. Billsley, thanks for calling.
Hi. I would strongly agree with the caveats on epidemiology that your guest has raised. Both... there are limitations both to controlled studies as well as to observational studies. Your controlled studies, your populations, as he's emphasized, represent volunteers who have agreed to a controlled study, and they are totally different, or not totally, but greatly different from the general population. They can make valid differences between those two groups, but it's very difficult in many circumstances to extend that to a large population. The same thing holds true in the sense of the observation. You don't have all the factors, as your guest has said. I can cite probably the most recent work that I'm doing now is the interest in circumcision and AIDS. Beautiful controlled studies have shown an effect in three countries. I have looked at all of the other countries for which I have data on circumcision, observational studies, and it's only those three that there is a significant difference in the observational studies between the circumcised and non-circumcised as far as AIDS. In the other, I think, something like 11 countries I have, there is absolutely no difference between the circumcised group and the non-circumcised group.
How do you explain it, and why does it show a limitation of epidemiology rather than a difference in populations?
In the sense that what goes with population is also differences in behavior. And even though individuals, most control studies are focused on technologies. You want to test a pill. You want to test an intervention. You want to see if it's effective. So you want to get a well-controlled study where you control for all these unknown variables, as well as the known variables. Circumcision for AIDS is simply a technology. Yes, it's a technology that works, but in many settings, the behavior patterns overwhelm the technology. The behavior patterns of the different ethnic groups that are being circumcised may be different from one another.
So, Gary Taubes, what's the moral of the story, according to you?
Well, the moral of the story, according to me, is if you've got 10 populations or 11 that show no effect and 3 that show an effect, I would be very skeptical of the effect. I would wonder what positive behavioral patterns in the populations that show an effect also could explain the decrease in AIDS. Again, one of the problems institutionally in this field is people tend only to pay attention to the data that supports their preconceived opinions or their beliefs. Maybe their beliefs are based on sound science, but in good science, it's the negative data. It's the data that appears to refute your hypothesis that you're supposed to put the most weight in.
Let's talk to another epidemiologist, Fred in Northport. You're on WNYC. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Gary Taubes, I've admired your work for some time, and I wanted to ask you about air pollution epidemiology studies, of which I'm an author of several. Most of those find effects on heart disease, and most of them don't control very well for diet. What is your take on that?
My personal belief is that the effect seen is too small to be taken seriously. These are if you're talking about the studies that I'm familiar with, we're talking about a few percent increase in risk.
Right.
And I just, you know, I've talked to, I forget the fellow's name at the moment.
The risk from air pollution for heart disease, is that what we're talking about?
Yes, a few percent, not tens of percent, but 2-5% increase risk. And I just don't believe the technology has a resolution to believe that kind of an effect, much as I would like to clean up the air. It's one reason. The one thing I didn't say in the story is many of the decisions in this field are based upon this sort of risk-benefit analysis of what happens if we make a change. So, for instance, with toxic chemicals in the workspace, it's very easy to say, let's just get rid of them. Except for the industry that might be harmed, there's no lobbying group that's going to come along and say there's going to be negative side effects if we get rid of this.
But those are
chemical.
The biggest lobbyist groups that there are, is those industries.
That's true. But nowadays, well, again, I don't know how things are changing with the current EPA and all. But for the most part, it's easy to make that decision that we got it right. Air pollution, easy to make the decision, even though the effects are so small.
But a 5% increase in risk doesn't sound like a lot. But over the course of 300 million Americans alive at any one time, what is that going to be? It's going to be thousands of preventable premature deaths.
That's the motivation for doing these studies. You take a small number that, as far as the science can tell, is indistinguishable from zero, but then you multiply it by 300 million, and you get a big number, and you say we could change, prevent tens of thousands of deaths a year. The problem is you may be multiplying zero by a big number. So then the question becomes, you know, everyone talks about the idea is this prudent to do? Is it prudent to tell people to pollute less? Well, I'll buy that.
Fred, do you want to come back on this?
Well, I certainly do. I can agree with everything that's been said here, but I would like to point out that the pendulum now is swinging away from industry and towards traffic big time. Our own studies are showing that. And the problem is that, and you can get risks larger than 10%, a factor of 2 in some cases, if you look at the extremes. You take people who are living right next to the road and compare those to the people that are living in the country.
Yeah, but now the problem is
you get a big difference, but you have a lot of other variables.
Yeah, I don't know enough about this to criticize it confidently, but as soon as you start looking at people who live right next to the roads, now you're bringing in other socioeconomic factors.
Absolutely.
The same problem I have. One of my good friends in epidemiology, he always wants to talk about electromagnetic fields in cancer because says there's always an effect that the people at the highest field strengths, you know, the ones who are living right under the power lines that you just can't explain away. And I don't want to talk about it with them because I say, you don't know what's happening there. It's like it's the point at which the study is least confident. It doesn't matter if you see an effect.
Fred, thank you for your call. Before you go, I think, and I haven't read your book, I've just read your articles, that you can't prove your hypothesis either. To bring this back to the thing that you're most interested in, which is that sugar, carbohydrates cause metabolic syndrome, which causes, well, we know it causes diabetes. Everybody agrees about that.
No.
But it also causes, can't, not what?
No.
People
they don't
agree.
Not, they believe diabetes now is caused by sedentary behavior.
And sugar, I thought. But if sugar rather than fat is the main dietary culprit in many things, then you don't have the studies to back that up either, do you? That's a hypothesis on your part.
Well, the point is you cannot prove any hypothesis true. That's something Popper reminded us. All you can do is refute the hypotheses and see which ones you have left. One of the arguments I make in the book, I look at all the evidence. The saturated fat hypothesis simply doesn't have a lot of evidence to support it, and the end result with the sugar, refined carbohydrate, you can't prove any hypothesis true. All you can say is, look, here's a compelling argument. Test it and try to refute it. And if you can't refute it, then we have to start taking it seriously.
Gary Taub's cover story in the New York Times Magazine this week is Unhealthy Science. His book coming out this month, Good Calories, Bad Calories, Challenging the Conventional Wisdom on Diet, Weight Control, and Disease, published by Knopf. Very thought-provoking. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, coming up in just a minute. Larry Josephson on his documentary series, airing on WNYC this week, Only in America, on 350 years of Jews in America. Stay with us.